The sun is rising on a clean energy age.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour podcast. We'd like to acknowledge, as always, that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're broadcasting from stolen land, land that was never ceded, always was, and always will be First Nations land. In the millennia that they've spent nurturing both their community and their country, they've gained a great deal of ancient wisdom that's going to serve us well as we face up to the climate crisis.
Imagine you were in a country where people were educated, where people understood that we are actually in danger, that this pollution that we're putting out in the atmosphere is out of control and we need to stop it. In a country where people trusted the science and where there was absolutely no debate about whether the climate risk is real or not. There's no Sky News banging on about how impossible it's going to be to switch over to renewables. There's no Barnaby Joyce clowns telling us to forget about cutting our carbon emissions to net zero by 2050. A country where more than half of all new cars coming out on the streets were electric, and where the municipalities and local governments invested heavily in buying electric buses and trains, and it's much more quiet in the streets. You know what? That country actually exists, and I am in it right now. Denmark. I've been here actually for some weeks, and today in the Sustainable Hour, I'll give you some glimpses of what it's like here. But before that, as usual, first of all, let's hear what's been happening around the world. With us, we have, as always, Colin Muckett, OAM, with his Global Outlook. Colin, what do you have for us today?
Yes, thank you, Mick. Well, our roundup this week, like you, begins in Europe, where the Weather Bureau, Copernicus, reported that fire emergencies are easing across most of southern Europe, as well as on the Iberian Peninsula, France, Italy and the Balkans, and in Greece. In short, the weather conditions have changed, allowing the firefighters to control the hundreds of fires that are still burning in southern Europe. But that same Copernicus report warned that the very high to extreme fire conditions are now expected in Ireland, the United Kingdom, and Northwest Europe. That's Belgium, the Netherlands, Northern Germany, Poland, Denmark, and parts of Sweden and Finland. You're in the firing line, Mick. You might want to come back. Large with very high to very extreme fire warning alerts are also issued along the Danube Basin in Austria, Hungary, and Romania inside the coming weeks. So the current Indian summer that Europe is expecting has got a little bit more bite to it yet to come. Now, of concern, of course, is Antarctica, where the news released this week that large and abrupt changes unfolding in the icy continent pose profound implications for Australia and the Pacific nations. An international team led by Australia, and including scientists from South Africa, Switzerland, France, Germany and the UK, published a report in the respected journal Nature that predicts sea levels could rise by 3 metres and emperor penguins could become extinct, both in this century. That was the headline report that has been in all the news in this hemisphere, Mick. But the true story is that Antarctica's melt rate is accelerating as a result of climate change, and the West Antarctic ice shelf is in severe risk of collapse. The ice shelf contains enough ice to raise sea levels by 3 meters, and the tipping point for unstoppable ice loss from the Western Antarctic ice sheet could be exceeded even under the best case emission reduction scenarios, the paper warned. So in other words, even if we all hit our targets, and I don't think there's any nations apart from the Scandinavian ones that are on target, even if we all hit it, that still the Antarctic ice shelf will be melting. Lead author Dr. Neril Abram, chief scientist at the Australian Antarctic Division, said such sea level rises would threaten the world's coastal cities and communities and result in, quote, catastrophic consequences for generations to come. Rapid change has already been detected across Antarctica's ice oceans and ecosystems, and this is set to worsen with every fraction of a degree of global warming, she said. The loss of Antarctic sea ice is another change that has a whole range of knock-on effects, including making the floating ice shelves around Antarctica more susceptible to wave-driven collapse. According to the peer-reviewed paper, there is evidence that the natural behaviour of Antarctic sea ice has changed over the past decade, as thinning sea ice and warming oceans create self-perpetuating changes. A critical threshold for the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet was estimated to be about 2 degrees of global average warming above pre-industrial temperatures, but a partial collapse could occur under lower temperatures, the paper reported. Now to New York, where the UN's 2025 Sustainable Development Goals report was released. Highlights are that it found some cities are already running on solar 95% of the time, and that energy that they're using is cheaper than coal-fired. It also noted that thanks to dramatic advances in battery technology, solar power can now run continuously day and night for up to 99% of the year in some of the sunniest cities. Now, this isn't just a forecast. From Hawaii to the UAE, real 24/365 solar plus storage systems are already powering homes, factories, and even data centers. The report names Johannesburg, Mexico City, and Hyderabad, where solar power paired with batteries can now deliver electricity for between 90 to 96% of the time. That's because battery prices have dropped 40% in just 1 year, the report said, and the tech is safer, cleaner, and longer lasting than ever. New modelling shows the combination of solar and batteries is now cheaper than coal or nuclear in many cities, even cloudy northern UK cities like Birmingham. But the standout winner appears to be Uruguay, which the report names as the only country that's currently using Earth's resources sustainably. Out of 195 countries, only one is statistically living within the planet's means, the report said, and it itemizes the reasons. Uruguay uses 98% renewable energy in wind, solar, and hydro. All those three dominate that nation's grid. It employs sustainable farming and prioritizes small-scale regenerative agriculture. It also has strong social policies, education, healthcare, and wages, support in a balanced economy. And it matches this with strong environment leadership, protected natural areas, and a focus on biodiversity. And the report was scathing of the other 194 countries, most of which are, it said, and this is a direct quote from the report, most nations are burning through resources as if there's a backup planet. Now, finally, I've been keeping this under wraps for a couple of weeks, but Forest Green Rovers, the world's most environmentally friendly sports team, is back and it's doing well. If you remember, the team missed promotion last season by a whisker, losing on penalties in the playoffs. But now, with a new manager in Steve Cotterill, and with a strengthened vegan policy, the team now takes its own vegan food to away matches. They're currently top of the English National League One. That's the fifth tier in their football league. That's for the 2025-26 season. Now, that's because they beat Halifax Town 2-1 away at the weekend. The Rovers now have 7 points from their four games that they've played, making it very early days, but an encouraging end to this week's Global Outlook.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Thanks for that. Great to hear the Rovers are right up there. We see ourselves as the unofficial Aussie cheer squad leaders.
Yep.
And we'll continue, and we'll try to get them on the show and see what they're about at the time.
Yeah, well, what's his name? Dale Vance, owner. He changed the manager after they didn't get promotion, and the fans all turned on him, but I think he'll be pretty popular again now.
Yeah.
Now they're top of the league again.
Success tends to do that.
Yep.
Okay, on with the show. Our guest today is no stranger to the Sustainable Hour. As we've said the last two or three weeks, Mick Ait has been in his home country in Denmark. So we thought we'd get an insider's view into what's happening, what's the latest in Denmark. Mick, so welcome to the Sustainable Hour as a guest for once.
Thank you very much, Tony and Colin.
Yeah, what are you seeing, Mick? What's impressed you about? Yeah, there were comments earlier today that sound you were pretty impressed with what's happening. So let's drill down on them a bit.
I am impressed, I must say. And I say that as, you know, a common tourist in a way. You know, I've come here not to learn about sustainability or climate action or things like that. I've come here to visit family and do some work. So that means the way I'm experiencing what Denmark is doing is just the normal way that people do it, which is what you see in the streets. It's what when you open a newspaper, when you're seeing the news in the evening on TV and so on. And the first thing, for instance, I noticed when I opened the newspapers is that there's a lot going on in terms of activities. There's festivals. There's a climate festival coming here in the end of this week. Last week, there was a major organic food festival in Copenhagen, which gathered people from 40 different countries where they're talking about organic food. And interestingly, there's a lot of talk at the moment about a festival which has a name that's difficult to translate. It's called a fellowship festival. And fellowship is a word we don't have in English. It means if you can combine togetherness and community, that's maybe the closest you can get to what fellowships mean. So there's a togetherness festival coming up soon, and people are talking quite a bit about that. So that's one thing, what you see in the newspapers. But obviously, the first thing that strikes me is in the streets. Things are really, really quickly getting electrified here. You see cyclists everywhere. People have really jumped up on their bicycles. Of course, it's summer in Denmark now. It's warm, and people just love cycling, and not just on two wheels, but on three wheels, four wheels, all sorts of funny vehicles, you would call them, are riding on the cycle pathways, cargo bikes and so on. It's really quite impressive. And you see, honestly, Teslas are everywhere. I was here a year ago, and since then, there must have been a huge sale of Teslas. Going around in the streets, you just see them everywhere. And not only Teslas, of course. As I mentioned before, 56% of all new cars that are sold are now electric in this country. And to compare that with Australia, in Australia the figure is 13%. So 1 out of 10 cars at the moment that's being sold in Australia is electric. Here is almost 6 out of 10 cars that's electric. And you can really feel that in the streets. And maybe even more significantly, The news were out just last week, and this was like a historical news that Denmark is getting off coal. Denmark has just had 3 months completely without coal in the electricity system. And that's a country that, you know, just a couple of years ago was really relying on coal as part of the energy supply. Now, it seems like they're on track on phasing out coal completely within just the next 3 years. So there's something for Australia to watch, I think. This is what it looks like when you live in the end of the age of fossil fuels.
And Mick, don't go any further because that's already thrown up three questions from me. Number one, what are they replacing coal with? Number two, are the bikes all pedal or are some of them electric? And number three, are people still using the sort of normal bus and trams and trains, public transport, or have they just replaced all that with bikes for this summer?
In terms of what replaced the coal, solar is coming up very big in Denmark. It used to be wind. We used to be famous for being actually the inventors of the wind turbine in a way. You know, the companies like Vestas have been like pioneers in that field. And we have another big company selling wind turbines all over the world called Ørsted, which is actually state-owned.
But
solar has moved in. And there's an interesting story there, Colin, about solar in Denmark, because Denmark actually now generates 2/3 of its electricity from wind and solar. But the rapid growth that there's been in renewable energy has led to an oversupply. And that's causing record levels of negative electricity prices, free energy, which means that the solar, what we call them farms, solar farms, are increasingly actually operating at a loss. So that again has meant that the renewable energy investments are stalling. And this is seen as a major problem because the Danes are really ambitious about actually reaching net zero, not in 2050, but sooner. So while Denmark is drowning in free electricity, the game changer will be cheaper battery storage. And that's coming in fast now. And that could be, you know, solving the problem and helping the green transition actually move forward, even if there are negative power prices. But can you believe it? You know, this is actually reality. In the last half year, Denmark has seen 536 hours of negative electricity prices. Last year, in the full year of last year, it was 650 hours of negative electricity prices. And already in the first half year, we're up to 536. So that'll be, if that continues, it'll be more than 1,000 hours of free energy in the system here.
What's the repercussions for that, Mick? Does this mean that they are no longer investing in solar panels? Are the solar panels on people's roofs or are they in solar farms? And is there now a sort of a backlash against putting them on your roof because people are saying, no, you don't get paid for the electricity you make? What's the consequence of what you're talking about?
It is solar farms we're generally talking about, you know, where people are investing in solar as a business. You see very little, I mean, much less than in Australia, of people putting solar on their own houses here. But there is a new trend, though, because places like IKEA is beginning to sell solar panels that people can put up on their balconies and fences, you know, put up on their garage and so on. And the cool thing about these IKEA solar panels is that not only do they look good, I think, but if you're a renter, you can take them with you when you move to some other place later on. You know, they're flexible. So there is a small-scale solar panel beginning to come up. But I think the most of the solar that you see in Denmark is solar farms. And the consequences of that, correctly, Colin, is that the business people are much more reluctant to invest in more solar by now. It's like the market is flooded. So that is seen as a problem. I think it's, well, I wouldn't be complaining. And consumers here are actually getting cheaper electricity by the day. So from an Australian perspective, wow, what a country where people are actually experiencing free energy. Why don't we hear about that in Australia?
If you wanna find the light, face the dark, dance with your shadow.
We're walking through firestorms, floods and decay. Truth feels like ash blowing further away. But roots are growing where the sun don't reach. In the cracks of despair, new hope starts to teach.
It's not the end.
It's not the end. It's the turning ground. Where silence cracks and new voices sound.
It's not the end.
Crisis is not destruction. It's the compost of transformation. From the shadows, we rebuild trust. Neighbor by neighbor, we share the sun.
From the shadows, we rebuild trust.
The only way we can solve the energy crisis and the price crisis permanently is to switch to renewable energy, 100%.
Rooftops clean, where panels shine, petals turning down the petrol line. Planting change in every street, with garden beds and sharing of seeds. The grassroots movement is growing. We're slowing down to build what's real. Time for laughter.
Solar panels in Pakistan. You could literally watch solar panels spreading like, you know, mushrooms after a rainstorm in the woods. They're just buying them, laying them on the ground, pointing them at the sun. Diesel sales dropped 35% last year in Pakistan, in 1 year. Those are the kind of numbers that change the world.
Sun to power the entire country.
If you want to find the light, face the dark.
There's power
dance with
in the soul.
Your shadow. If you want to find the light, face the dark. There's power in the soil, fire in.
The story that really just blew my mind was what happened in Pakistan over the last year or so. A year ago in Pakistan, people, energy analysts started saying something weird is happening because demand for electricity on the national grid is dropping. As you know, as an energy analyst, humans never use less energy. Demand number always goes up, as they say. So the fact that it was dropping was befuddling. What was happening here? And then good analysts started looking at pictures on Google Earth. And if you looked at the rooftops of Lahore or Karachi or Islamabad, you could literally watch solar panels spreading like, you know, mushrooms after a rainstorm in the woods. I mean, just the growth was literally week to week. In the course of 8 months last year, Pakistanis built the equivalent of half the country's national electric grid. by themselves without anyone, you know. And when I talked to people and said, how did people even like manage to do it? Obviously, the key component was cheap Chinese solar panels coming across the border with China.
Yep.
But how did they put them up? Well, it turns out that there are 300 or 400 great TikTok videos with Hindustani music in the background where people explain how to snap this stuff together and how to put it up. And the bottom line there, the number that killed me was that, I mean, I've spent some time in rural Asia, so I know that the soundtrack of kind of village Asia is diesel generators humming along to pump those deep tube wells that were the residue of the Green Revolution in the 60s. That diesel is usually the biggest input for farmers. It's expensive. Farmers were the first people to really start doing this in Pakistan. They often lack the money to build the steel supports that we're used to seeing for solar panels. They're just buying them, laying them on the ground, pointing them at the sun. Diesel sales dropped 35% last year in Pakistan, in 1 year. Those are the kind of numbers that change the world.
The only way we can solve the energy crisis and the price crisis permanently is to switch to renewable energy 100%.
Well, hang on a second. That's all well and good, but massive subsidies have gone into renewables, particularly wind farms.
In the past. So right now, onshore wind and solar need no public money. If the government were to change the planning regime to give them an equal footing to other forms of energy, we could build all the energy that we need. We have enough wind and sun to power the entire country. So this year...
But not when the wind doesn't blow.
No, no, but that's a balancing issue. And National Grid say that we can run the country 100% on renewables. So I think there's some credibility there. This year, we'll spend £150 billion on our electricity bills. It's madness. It's 10 times what they used to be. If we were powered by the wind and the sun, we'd be spending £15 billion, and that's crippling our economy.
Now, to this two other questions you had about which kind of bikes you see in the streets and also whether people use public transport. I would say about the bikes, there's really a variety of bikes, but a lot of them are electric. I don't have the figures, but it seems to me like probably a third or half of all the bikes that you see in the streets have a battery on the back. And means also that people are moving much faster than you're used to. You actually got to watch out when you come near a bike path because there's fast speed on these bicycles there. But also I see really a massive increase in the use of bikes that are looking different than bikes. In particular, cargo bikes where, for instance, you can transport another person. In front, you have like a box and it's big enough for people to sit there. And you see a lot of people transporting each other, transporting kids, but also transporting adults.
Yeah.
And the last one about public transport, there's a lot of investment in public transport in Denmark, and it's already a country that's pretty well connected with the public transport system. And for instance, you're hearing a train just passing outside my window where I'm talking now, but these trains are being turned into electric trains. So they're putting up cords, wires above the trains, and they run on electricity instead of diesel. So that's happening big time. And I can tell you that the town that I'm in, which is my birth town, Aarhus, is really keen on getting the cars out of the town and instead just relying on public transport in the center of town. Just like we see in Melbourne, you know, where the tram system in the inner city is free. Similar ideas are coming up here in Denmark.
Yep. Two impediments here, Mick, are a government's lack of will. The evidence of that is continuing to approve fossil fuel projects. And also media, mainstream media, keep continually talk down the transition. How is Denmark on those two spheres?
I think what's really important to understand and a huge difference is that when I open the TV in the night and I watch the TV news on different channels, in the national mainstream news, both on commercial and public broadcasters, climate and weather is being mixed together in one pot. So you'd hear what in Australia would be the weather report. But here in Denmark, the weather report also has news that are climate related. These things are seen here as two sides of the same story. You hear the connection about a flooding or heat waves in southern part of Europe and so on, and it's being explained in a climate context properly. That makes a huge difference when you see this being taken serious at the sort of educational level. So I really believe that that is why the Danes understand and acknowledge that action is necessary. And they are even, I think, taking it to the next level, where they're beginning to ask, okay, if we have to change the system, how can we change it in a way where it makes our lives better, our lives more happy? This was actually a question asked at this organic summit that was in Copenhagen last week, where I read a newspaper article about it. And someone had been asking, and there was a discussion about how should we change the system to make life happy, someone said. And that's the next level, isn't it? Where we're not just talking about it as a necessity, something we need to do, and it's expensive, we're complaining, but we're beginning to look at where does it actually improve our lives? And how do we benefit from changing the system?
Well, you can start by going to the Togetherness Festival, Mick.
Yes, I know.
Yep.
I know.
Look, you'll notice when you get back, you've been in Denmark for the past 3 weeks. I reckon over the past 3 weeks, we must have we've seen a similar change on Geelong's roads that you've noticed in Copenhagen. Only the difference is we're not getting people on bikes. We're getting more and more people in giant American utes that are so big, they're bigger than the supermarket car parks, and they're getting people angry, and motorists are wild because they're too big for the small 1930s roads that we've got. But that doesn't stop people buying them. Basically, it was the Morrison government, if my memory serves me right, that changed the tax structure to make big utes cheaper comparatively than a standard Toyota Corolla. And so that's why, and you know, I'm saying things like these are the things, but this is the trade of the future and stuff like that. Now, mums are dropping their kids off at school in great big Ram utes. And even, you know, the school traffic is jammed with the things. So we've gone the complete opposite way to Denmark. That's just a comment. That's not a question. My question is, right now, it's late summer coming into autumn there. When is the time when most electricity is used? I'm assuming it would be during the winter.
Yes, that's correct.
And in that case, the problem that you're getting with the too cheap electricity is going to dissolve, isn't it? Because there's not going to be the same amount of sunshine and there's going to be more demand for the power.
Yes, it requires quite a bit of energy to heat the houses here because it does get really, you know, below zero outside. However, the Danes have also, in the major cities, come up with a system where water is running in pipes and being exchanged, going from one house to the next and heating up the houses simply by you know, tubes running through the houses with warm water. And the energy for this, heating this water, is increasingly coming from waste energy, let's say from a factory that's going to produce something industrial and there's a lot of waste heat. That waste heat is then used to warm the water. And so there's a bit of recycling of energy, you could say, where the houses are increasingly being heated by very cheap energy that was going to just go waste otherwise. And the other thing is there's some geothermal experiments happening right here in Aarhus, where I am. They're beginning to drill like 60 meters down where there's hot water down there and then take that water up and heat the houses with that. There's two places here in Aarhus where they're beginning these tests on taking up, you know, the heat from the underground. And that's just, you know, work in progress, I would say. They haven't really shown yet that it's a game changer, but it could be.
Mick, you've mentioned Aarhus a couple of times now, and that's it. It's your home city. How is it viewed amongst other cities in Denmark? Like, is it a leader in the field of sustainability, just midfield? Yeah. What's its whole approach?
I think if you ask the people at the municipality here, they certainly would like to become the leader. But Copenhagen is very far ahead in many aspects. So there is a bit of competition. Aarhus is the second largest city in Denmark. So, you know, the largest city is Copenhagen, the capital, and then there's Aarhus. And these two cities, in a way, have always been competing on many levels. Certainly, I can remember when I grew up, you know, with culture and music, Aarhus was trying to claim that, you know, this is the capital of culture, capital of music, and so on. And I know the ambition is there. However, you know, there's also, and this was a real shock that came out from the University of Aarhus just last week, which was a study that showed that the beech forest, and when I say beech, it's spelled B-E-E, beech, these trees that are very tall, and in springtime they're incredibly light green, beautiful trees, they are in trouble. They're actually, you know, feeling the heat from climate change. And these are, you know, iconic trees. They have been celebrated in songs. They're part of our national identity. And now this university study tells us that these trees are not going to be here by the end of this century unless the world very, very quickly now decides to turn things around and do something about our air pollution, our carbon emissions. And to imagine a Denmark without beech forests is like, I think it's very close to how Australians feel when they hear that the Great Barrier Reef is in trouble and dying. It touches you emotionally. So last week there was some beech forest grief when I talked with people who had heard about this report. So that's another aspect as well. You know, our iconic beech trees have been given a death sentence. That doesn't feel very good. It just adds to that feeling here in Denmark that we need to do something. And there's a general consensus about that. I can tell you that. There's a general consensus. People are on board. And not just like a little group of climate activists, but the vast majority of the Danes are on board in one way or the other. They are making changes at a personal level, and they're supporting that the politicians invest in this and spend public money on the green transition. Welcome to the green
transition. Australia has called for a phase out of fossil fuels.
The world is turning faster than before between rightness and love and power and light.
I've seen the floods, I've felt the storms. Watch the news as cities drown. Want to shut off, can't watch this breakdown. It's hard to see, we can turn this ship around. They say it's too late, they say just wait. But I won't watch it wash away. I choose the truth, I change my ways. I've signed up and I'm ready to join. The green transition is inevitable. From home to work, from town to town. The green transition is inevitable. The wind is strong, the air is clean, life is fun.
They call them natural disasters untamed, but I know better. I know who's to blame. Coal, gas, oil, the damage they do. But I'm the one that chooses. I know what's true. They said just go slow, don't shake the ground, but I refuse to back down.
You should lead. You should lead this revolution.
Not someday, no, right here, right now. I make it right, I make it count.
Australia has called for a phase out of fossil fuels.
The green transition is inevitable.
From land to sea, around the world, the green transition is inevitable. A great renewal, a bold decision.
I build, I vote, I call out the lies. We shape the rules, we change the tide. It's not impossible, it's on the rise. A world reborn before our eyes. Welcome to the green transition. It's in our hands, it's underway. No more waiting, the time is now. We rise together, this is the way.
You should lead this revolution.
What is the makeup of the federal and the state parliament where you are, Mick? Have you got green members and green senators? Have you got a conservative party of any strength at all?
Denmark is very different from Australian politics in the sense that we don't have two major parties. We have a big diversity of parties, like 10 different parties in parliament, and they're all negotiating. And typically to form a government, you need to have at least two or three parties that come together in a coalition, and then they run the country. And it's been like that for a century here. That's completely normal. So what's being called a hung parliament in Australia is just how we know democracy in Denmark. And yes, there are conservative parties, and there are sort of middle-of-the-road parties, and there are left-wing parties. But we don't have a specifically green party. We do have a very tiny climate party, actually, that didn't make it into parliament last time. And we do have some parties, especially one called the Alternative, that have very strong climate policies. They're still small, but who knows? We had a big climate election, it was called, back in 2019, that's 6 years ago, which really gave the politicians a mandate to begin to invest in wind power and solar power and all these things. And for instance, electric cars here are not much more expensive than normal petrol cars, which is, of course, the reason that people buy electric.
And at the moment, the power grid, is that state-owned or is that all private industry?
It has been privatized, similar to how we've seen it in Australia. However, some of the major electricity providers are still like half state-owned and so on. So it's a little bit of a mix, I would say.
So basically, there's not too big a difference politically between the two nations. The big difference is, hey, wait a minute, there's one other big thing that could be it. News International, who runs your major newspapers in Denmark?
Each newspaper has its own owner.
And are any of them Rupert Murdoch's?
To my knowledge, no.
And is there a sort of a Danish equivalent to the ABC?
Very much so, yes. It's called the Danish Broadcasting Corporation.
Do many people use that?
Yes. Yes, I would say that's quite common, and they have a large chunk of the population listening to or watching them every day.
So that could be the big difference, because it strikes me the big difference is the will of the people.
That's right.
The people of Denmark have, encompassed the whole ideal of climate change, and they're quite happy to change their own behaviour. Whereas in Australia, we're not, and we're encouraged not to by the press and the media.
And I think, Colin, what's really deep down behind all of this is that the Danes are brought up in a spirit of trust. Trust is incredibly important in the Danish society, and it goes 1,000 years back to, this is something I have learned, that the Vikings were the inventors of this society where people actually trust each other. And trust means that when you grow up, you trust, you know, your teacher, you trust your parents, eventually you trust the government, and you trust the scientists, not the least. So I think that could be a big difference. Where when I live in Australia, I sense this sort of mistrust in many aspects of our lives. We don't really trust our politicians, that's for sure. We don't trust the journalist either.
Each year, the Reader's Digest Association holds a poll on the most trusted people and the least trusted people. And the three people that are least trusted, the ones that come below used car dealers, are real estate agents, politicians and journalists. And that's standard in Australia. It's been that way for at least 30 years. Since I used to be a journalist, it used to upset me because I used to try very hard to be as honest as I could. But yes, you're correct. And you're saying that in Denmark, it's not that way at all.
I think if the Danes saw people like Barnaby Joyce, you know, they would laugh. They would say, yeah. Is he for real? And when they, if they listened to something like Sky News banging on about, oh, it's, you know, literally spreading lies about how expensive or how terrible renewables are. You know, yes, we do have deniers in Denmark just as well, but honestly, you don't hear about them. They are not in the public sphere.
Yeah, I think Colin nailed it when he said the public will is there, maybe because of that trust, but it's they realise what needs to happen. And when they get messages like their iconic beech trees are dying because of what's happening in the atmosphere, you know, that's the thing that they trust. It can't be cheated, no matter whether you say you're meeting your targets or not. The atmosphere knows what's going up there. Yeah,
that's right. And always, I think the media is careful to when they deliver bad news, negative news about heat waves and droughts and all this, they always come up with a bit of solutions as well. That's really, I sense that as a responsibility of a public broadcaster to not just leave people there with the doom and gloom, but actually to come with that. For instance, when the news was up about the beech forest, there was also at the end someone saying they haven't died yet, not just yet.
Yeah.
And with stronger climate action, we can actually still save the beech forest. There's always that element to it, and this is really important. That's what keeps people working, or working harder on trying to stop the pollution and get into something that doesn't harm the climate.
Is there a climate movement as such, Mick?
There is a growing climate movement in Denmark. It has, you know, if I look back 10 years, it's been very weak compared to the Australian climate movement. However, for instance, this big summit that's coming up end of this week here in Denmark shows that there's a very strong collaboration, for instance, from the business sector. So the public sector, the business sector, and the climate activists are actually talking together and having these kind of summits or conferences and places where they all discuss over 2 days what needs to get done and how we can speed up solutions and cutting the emissions. So I would say there's a strong movement in Denmark, but it's different. It's less of people going in the streets with banners, and it's more like actually in the business world and you know in the offices of both politicians and municipalities and businesses that are talking together with the community about new solutions, what can be done.
This is Carl. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies.
That's all we could fit in 1 hour where we didn't even have a guest, but just the three of us talking about Denmark in this case. And I do have actually, you know, some guests coming up from Denmark who I've been speaking with. So we'll be dropping some interviews in the next weeks and months, maybe. The thinkers and the doers speaking about what's happening in Denmark. Not, don't just take my word for it. That's coming up in the following weeks. But isn't it incredible how fast an hour goes when you're just talking about something that I know we're all three very curious and investigative about?
Well, look, one of the things that's been in our media over the course of the last week has been a sort of pushback from right-wing councillors to undo the climate emergency things that we pushed very much about, I don't know, what, 3 or 4 years ago. They're now saying that was an overreaction, and the councillors who got voted in on back to basics, that's now become a sort of a code word for let's go soft on the climate because we're going to move back to conservatism.
And Colin, can I just give a plug here once again for the interview which we aired at the Pulse 2 weeks ago with Joseph Gelfer from the United Kingdom, who speaks, I think, very cleverly about that maybe that's not so bad as we think, you know, giving up on the climate emergency narrative at this stage. What he suggests is that we simply need to even stop talking about climate and instead talk about things that people relate to, their health, cost of living, nature, these kind of topics that matter to them. Because climate is behind it all, but you don't need to put it up front. So instead of fighting on the barricades for protecting the climate emergency word, let's talk about the real things that matter to people and try to win them. And that includes not only the people who live in our council, but also, as you said, the right-wing councillors. I think if you look at what climate is, if you take away the lies, it is a threat to everything we love, everything we hold dear. And that's the story that we all need to come together around. It should be possible, but we might have to change our rhetorics.
Well, you go to the Togetherness Festival and tell us how it worked.
I'll see if I can sign up for it. I'm afraid I'll be out of the country by the time it runs. It's on the 6th and 7th of September, where, as we talked about last week, there's also some interesting things happening in Geelong as well as in Melbourne. So that'll be a busy weekend, both in Denmark and in Geelong, Australia.
Yep. Thanks for that, Mick. Really appreciate the chat.
Thank you. And we've actually reached the B section of the Sustainable Hour. What are we going to be today? I would say be together.
Yeah. Be together.
With friendship.
Be united together with friendship.
Looking at your face right now, as you scroll through the headlines, I see the worry in your eyes about the world we leave behind. And I know you wonder if anyone will make it right. But baby, let me tell you something that keeps me up at night. There's still time to change the way things are going day by day. And when you feel like giving up, remember what I say. I can be that difference. I can be that change. Difference starting from today. I've seen the videos of how things used to be, clear skies and clean waters. It's hard to believe, but am I just sitting here waiting for a miracle? Got my friends beside me now, we're making it possible. Every small step counts, they say. Little changes pave the way. When it seems too much to bear, listen close, I swear. I can be that difference. I can be that change.
My name is Hannah Ferguson, and we are in Exmouth, NWA. Well, we're basically on Ningaloo Reef. It's a little while away. I've come here with the Australian Conservation Foundation. We've been looking at some of the impacts of climate change on the coral on Ningaloo Reef, the coral bleaching, the effects, what the damage has been to the area, and talking a lot to locals in the community about their experience with how they've seen the changes in the last year to 5 years. We went out on the reef yesterday for a full day on the boat and saw just an array of dead coral. And we saw it contrasted directly against other areas of the reef that were intact, that were recovering from bleaching events. But it was heartbreaking too, because you get out of the water every time and think, how have we let this happen? The government is currently allowing the fossil fuel industry to dictate what is going to be left on this planet for future generations. And I am not overstating, that is not hyperbolic. This is the reality we're living with, and we need to be incredibly clear about the fact that industry is currently dictating what the future of this land looks like. The government frames the EPBC Act and strengthening that as a decision between jobs and industry and between protecting nature. And that's just not really the question that's actually being asked here. Because if we think about the impact on tourism communities like this one, on local communities that are experiencing significant environmental damage to the hearts of their homes, there are major job losses that are going to be occurring in these areas, not just in industry. And I think that nature's resilience in the face of what humans have done is a hopeful message, but it shouldn't have to be that way. My message would be to Labor, you have a supermajority, do something.
Well, all I can say is, are you kidding? I speak not only for myself, but as an advocate for younger Australians who are facing an uncertain future. The motion put forward by Senator Hanson to scrap net zero indicates a severe lack of knowledge and a complete disregard for the future of our generation, the future of our country. Without a net zero target, there will be no Australian farmers, businesses or industries to support us. Net zero is waking up to a reality that Senator Hanson has not been able to grasp. In fact, Senator Hanson seems to be hell-bent on exacerbating all of the consequences of climate change.
Wind turbines are actually terrible for the environment. Speaking for Greenpeace UK, you might not expect me to say that. And the reason you might not expect it is, well, it's not true. The thing is, when someone says something vague like, it's bad for the environment, usually they've identified some environmental issues, but are they really telling you the whole picture? I mean, take for example the argument that wind turbines can kill birds, which is bad, but it ignores the fact that there's a lot of things that kill birds. Windows, for example, kill over a billion birds each year, but no one complains about windows. And by the way, climate change, that thing that we're trying to avoid with the wind turbines, well, that threatens millions of animal species with extinction, so it's kind of a bit worse. Or someone might criticise wind turbines for requiring energy to build, but somehow ignore the fact that they'll produce more energy, or that coal mines and oil rigs also require energy to build. Now, at this point, someone might helpfully suggest switching to squeaky clean nuclear energy, maybe pointing out the current issue with disposing of wind turbine blades, but ignoring the fact that nuclear waste will be dangerously radioactive for up to hundreds of thousands of years. And lastly, someone might say that wind turbines are just ugly, ignoring the fact that pretty much all power plants are fugly. 80% of the public are actually in favour of onshore wind. I mean, personally, I think they look Pretty stunning.